Hello and welcome to episode 3. Yes, Irish people really don't pronounce their H's, of Barstool Biology. I'm your host, Gary Somerville, and I have another fantastic guest joining me on today's podcast, Joe Rogan. I'm coming for you and that $100 million Spotify deal, buddy. His name is Dr. Colm Ryan. No prizes for guessing. He is a fellow Irish scientist. He has a PhD in biochemistry and is now both a founder and CEO of Reagent Genie, a company which supplies reagents to enable scientists like myself to carry out very important research of all different genres. But most recently, his company just launched some innovative COVID-19 molecular and point-of-care rapid tests to help fight this global pandemic. So we're going to have a very relevant conversation about testing and how we can use it going forward to kick the shit out of this virus together. You may be somebody or know somebody that's gotten a swab rotated inside their nose or given a blood sample over the last few months. But do we actually know what happens once the material from your snout or blood is sent off to the lab for testing, which in some cases can be done on site or take a few days? Well, you're about to find out exactly what happens from myself and Colm. And veteran listeners of Barstool Biology, which is literally two episodes, will already know this, but if this is your first time tuning in, adult beverages are strongly encouraged in this virtual learning environment / pub. So put the feet up, relax, as we serve up science in the form of coronavirus testing. Dr. Colm Ryan, thanks for joining me on Barstool Biology. I have no doubt, as the CEO of a company, you're a very busy man, so I appreciate your time, considering we're in two different time zones. So how are you doing, Colm?
Great, Gary. Listen, doing really well. Thanks a lot for having me on. Looking out on a sunny park, but I'm the only person in the office today. That's lockdown for you.
I'm sure you're getting lots done with nobody around to annoy you. It's fairly warm here in Boston as well. Can you give us a brief background about what you're up to at the moment in the science game? I've seen a few articles about you and your company across some different forms of media. So safe to say, to quote the great philosopher Ron Burgundy, you're kind of a big deal at the moment.
a good guy to be quoting from there. So really, we set up the company 3 years ago, and our headquarters are in London, all the way of operations and logistics in Dublin. And what we do is we provide life science tools for researchers in academia, life science, and biotech pharma all over the world. So from Boston to Beijing, actually. I suppose in the last year, well, in the last few months, actually, even going back as far as December, a kind of an interesting situation arose in that we have component manufacturers, a few from Wuhan, as it turns out. And oh, wow. I've been there a few times. And so you can imagine it's been an absolutely crazy year for us from the beginning right up until now, and even as it happened. So what actually happened was we've noticed that supply chain was severely compressed early on in the year because of the crisis that was happening in China.
So you kind of saw from early on that it was going to be a bit of a shit show, did you?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. And, you know, our suppliers, for our components suppliers, were telling us, like, situation was getting worse, and, you know, it was really bad, and so on and so forth. And obviously, like, that had a big impact on us. So really, what we started to do very early was go, look, could we, in case anything happens in Europe, how can we actually help and let's get ahead of the curve and maybe develop something? So what we did was we looked into developing some rapid test technology. And actually what happened was, as we started developing it, we realized that actually, you know what, China was way ahead of the curve, because I don't want to get too political on it. But I think they were aware of problems there for quite a while, and okay. Technology had accelerated. So actually, I mean, we're still developing our own test, but we are actually providing tests from other providers at the moment due to the demand and to help meet the demand and bring the technology to the market. That's just for rapids, but we also have ELISA and XR tests as well.
So it's all hands on deck for Reagent Genie at the moment, yeah?
Yeah, although I will say I'm the only person in the office.
Sunshine in Irish people generally means a big bag of cans outside by a canal somewhere. So I'm not surprised.
Listen, at 1 o'clock I'm gone. No, I'm joking.
Right, well, I won't keep you too long. So you said you're in the office. We chat science, and it's, you know, it's 7 a.m. here in Boston. And I am kicking my weekend off, right, with a cool can of Cloud Candy, which is, I'm going to sound like a real craft beer douchebag here, is a 6.5% double dry hopped New England style IPA from Mighty Squirrel Brewing Company in Waltham, Massachusetts. That's a bit of a mouthful, and I'll be taking plenty of those over the next 20 minutes or so chatting. So I don't know if you guys have a sneaky one or two in the office, but I'm going to be having one here as we chat, because this is Barstool Biology and it's warm, so it's refreshment at the same time. So we'll get into science. Colm, your background is in biochemistry, right? Primarily. Yeah. So in the last episode with Dr. Andrew Hogan, which you know, I think the immunology / biochemistry world in Ireland is fairly small. So everybody knows everybody. We touched on antibody testing. So we get to expand on that today, as well as testing for active infection in people. And the majority of tests for COVID-19 are mainly divided into either a molecular biology technique, as you said earlier, PCR, polymerase chain reaction, or serological tests. And both of them use different types of samples to search for different hallmarks of SARS-CoV-2. And neither of them are exactly perfect, which we'll get into. So I'm going to give us a little history lesson here, Colm, real quick to set the stage before we dive into what exactly a PCR test is. And interestingly, you may know this, legend has it that the American biochemist and one of the goats of molecular biology who came up with the idea of PCR back in 1983, a man called Carey Mullis, who actually, he only passed away there, I believe it was from pneumonia last August, so a big loss to science. But he actually came up with the idea, tripping balls on LSD apparently while driving out in California. Not sure if you heard that story, but that's what the legend says anyway. And he won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry 10 years later. So I'm not encouraging the use of hallucinogens here on Barstool Biology, but it may help you get creative. So at the moment, the majority of COVID-19 tests use the PCR method. And that is using material taken from the back of your nose with a swab, and it detects the presence of genetic information of the virus. And listeners to the podcast may know from episode 1, the genetic material of this virus is RNA, and it has a unique code, kind of similar to SARS of 2003, but slightly different. So that's the kind of intro to what PCR is, Colm. But what does the actual PCR process involve itself? As I know you guys have this rapid PCR test. So can you tell the listeners what actually is PCR?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And it kind of goes back to undergrad year one biochemistry, which I've forgotten most of. Actually, I forgot it pretty soon after I crammed for my exams, to be honest with you. But yeah, and I think it's a very good point to go back to, actually, you know, I suppose RNA and DNA and what do they mean and why it's important to measure for these as well. I think if you look at it, I kind of describe it very simply as well. And it depends on who the listeners are, essentially, whether they're, you know, professors or just lay people interested in molecular biology and stuff. But I mean, I often think of it as DNA and, I suppose, RNA really to be like the blueprints. That's kind of an overused term, but I do think it's pretty accurate. And I mean, if you look at, say, car design, very similar, like you have the engineer will write up the plans or the design for a car. And similarly, like that's very similar to what DNA is. DNA is essentially the plans of what you're going to build or what cells are going to build. And similarly, in the car manufacturing process, little machines will read the designs and turn it into a car, and a car will drive and do things. And similarly with DNA, like you'll get little machines in your cells, proteins will come along, read the DNA, turn it into RNA, which in turn will then be turned into enzymes and proteins and do all the jobs in your cell. So you can imagine then any problems in the design of a car will lead to the wheels falling off and the car not working, not being able to go anywhere. And similarly with DNA, if there's any problems in the DNA or the structure, any mutations per se, then you'll get different diseases and problems, cancers and things. But so you can imagine a virus then, and in particular SARS will have, it's an RNA virus, and it'll have unique parts in those plans. And if we can detect those unique parts, well then that are specific to SARS-CoV-2, well then we can actively identify that particular virus. And therefore that leads to PCR and how you do it. And so really what you want to do is, as you mentioned, you collect the sample, but then you're really looking to extract the RNA out of the virus. And what you do is you would get your sample and you'd mix it with some chemicals, harsh chemicals that will break the virus open and release the RNA into the solution. And then you want to extract the RNA, and you do that. There's different methods. There's column-based methods, nothing to do with me. I can't take any credit for that, Mike. and then you have magnetic bead based methods too. So they're there for high throughput, so you can do millions at one go, but thousands at a time. And so anyway, once you break open the virus and you extract and purify the RNA, then you want to see how can you detect it. And that's when you come back to good old Carrie Mullis and polymerase chain reaction PCR. Actually, my son's name, sorry, I'm going to digress actually for a second. This is unintentional. My son's name is Patrick and his middle name is Colm and he's Ryan PCR. Is that sad?
Oh, that is, was that pure coincidence or that was by design?
No, it's coincidence, but no, seriously, it's coincidence.
That's when crazy. I realized
it is. It's not right. I don't think it's too nerdy. but anyway, really, then you use PCR, and what you do is you design specific primers. Well, they're called primers, specific piece of genetic material, really, that will bind to this sequence in the virus, and then it'll amplify it, so it'll make thousands of pieces of this unique part, and you use a machine basically to read this. And that's how it works in a nutshell.
It's kind of a bit of witchcraft, really. Like, I know we mentioned it before we went on. It's there's kind of some dark arts to what goes on, because, you know, you're putting, I kind of, the analogy I use sometimes is like, if you're a good cook or a good chef, you're probably going to be good at PCR, because you have your ingredients, which in this case are the chemicals and the reagents and samples. And then you have your cooking conditions, which in this case are the program that you put on this. It's like a toaster almost, but its official name is a thermocycler, which is probably about the size of a toaster these days. They've gotten fairly small. So you have your instructions, you have your ingredients, and then you lash it all together in this big box, and then out is your result. Which in this case is kind of like a positive or negative. So there is a bit of witchcraft, and how it kind of works, you've touched on it, is basically works through fluorescent reading. So material is labeled with these little fluorescent markers. So the amount of fluorescence released in the amplification process is kind of directly proportional to the amount of amplified DNA. So because it's monitored the whole time, the higher the number of viral molecules at the start, the faster the fluorescence will increase. So in other words, if a sample has more viral targets, the fluorescence is going to be detected earlier and the machine will pick up that positive result. If the specimen has no coronavirus, there's going to be a negative result. So happy days. So that's kind of how it works. The sample, the chemicals, put it all in, cook it for a little bit, and then the scientist on the other end gets the answer. So you guys have, this is your realm right now. And a lot of what I've been seeing in media, Colm, is that there's concerns about false positives and negatives in the PCR test, especially when there's such an emphasis on trying to get something out onto the market very, very quickly. Now, as people that have done PCR and experiments like this may know, these things typically take a while to design before you get them up and running. So the world is really looking for this to get going fairly quickly. And the concern is it very robust? And we saw a study there in South Korea that they were worried that people were actually getting reinfected a second time, but it turns out that it was just chunks of the virus that were actually dead that were floating around. And the PCR these days is so sensitive, it picks up absolutely everything. So is there still those concerns, Colm, that there's some false, you know, a false positive would be, you know, someone probably quarantined for 2 weeks when more than likely they didn't need to be. And then a false negative is like, you know, you're grand and then this person is out in the wild and potentially infecting other people. Are those still concerns for the PCR test?
I think less so for PCR testing. Like, I mean, as you've done, I'd say more PCR than Carrie Mullis himself, I'd say.
I could do it in my sleep at this stage, Colm.
But like, like PCR, as you kind of alluded to, like it's highly specific. So I suppose there are low rates of false positives, right? Like the sensitivity or, you know, there could be, depending on when the sample's collected or, you know, you mentioned there are issues with clumping and so on and so forth, or dead virus floating around. Like there might be some false negatives. But like, I think for PCR, you know, generally, really highly specific, and that's a very good thing, and they're designed very carefully. But you know, the chemistry is still fairly, you know, you mentioned like the analogy to cooking, and I think you're dead right. A lot of scientists, I think, make good cooks as well. I wonder, do good cooks make good scientists? That's the other thing.
Well, my other half would probably disagree. She's like, you're shite in the kitchen. So I don't know. Maybe they don't. Maybe the skill set is not transferable, but I do my best when I can. So yeah, that's kind of, it is in a way, it is like cooking. So you said like kind of early on, there was some issues, you know, that we're kind of fast tracking these kits and even the extraction kits as well. Like, you always see these reports, there's bogey kits and the kits are malfunctioning and stuff like that. Do you think now the sensitivity is there where it's picking up everything that it's supposed to do?
Yeah, like I think once again, PCR, due to the nature of the way it works, it's a very good system for detecting the virus. But it's not perfect. And you're right, you mentioned extraction there, and you mentioned, is there new technology that'll supersede it or help it be a much better assay? I think actually the kind of media, and this is just from my reading, I think the media is much more focused on, on other types of technology when it comes to, say, antibody testing and the issues that would have over PCR. Now, the two are not, there's a place for the two, and I think absolutely how we do that. But I think for PCR, it seems to have got its act together. And it got its act together pretty early. Now, obviously, if there's not enough virus there to be detected, or you take the sample too early or too late, or, you know, or there's problems with extraction, well, then it's going to have sensitivity. And there's probably not a lot you can do except improve the processes around PCR. But I think it's interesting, what you actually mentioned earlier, irrespective of the technology used, how does either having false positives or false negatives affect us, the way we work, the way we live our lives, and from the future of the economy. And then you can see, irrespective of what testing you use, if you have loads of false, so sometimes false positives are an issue and sometimes false negatives are an issue. Mm-hmm. Depends on who you are, what you're doing. You know, like, for example, if you had a fall, or if I was misdiagnosed and I was diagnosed as positive, but I was negative and I had to self-isolate for 2 weeks. Yeah. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
You know, for me, but actually, interestingly, we work with people in healthcare and it's a massive issue because, like, you know, if, you're down to critical levels of frontline workers and you want them all working optimally, so you don't have staff shortages, and they're crucial. And if there's false positives there, well, then they have to self-isolate for two weeks. Mm-hmm. And that is a major problem.
Yeah, you're taking soldiers off the front line there and you're kind of stretching yourself very thin. Yeah, that's it. That's a good point. So I mentioned earlier on that Reagent Genie has some kind of rapid tests and stuff like that. And you mentioned how the technology has gotten better. So you guys have managed to like shave time off this whole process, because, you know, I've done these extractions where you're taking the genetic material from a sample, that takes time, and then you're putting it into this PCR, that takes time, and then once it's in the machine and you analyze the results, that takes time. But you guys seem to have tests now that kind of, I wouldn't say cut corners, that's a bad phrase to use, but definitely shave some time off this whole process. Like, how have you managed to do that, Colin? Like, how does that part work? We mentioned kind of what the vanilla PCR test would involve, but you guys are kind of speeding things up a little bit.
Well, I suppose to maybe clarify, we do supply, how's that beer actually?
Just took a big swig of it there. It's very nice, I have to say. Maybe they'll sponsor this podcast moving forward. Or maybe it's just I'm drinking a beer at like 7:30, which is, you know, the novelty of it's real nice. It's like airport drills when I'm doing this podcast, you know, anything goes.
Yeah, so really for our Assay Genie brand, we actually produce PCR tests. Now, they're normal length PCR tests. I suppose maybe, and what's been kind of media reports really around our rapid antibody-based tests, which are 15-minute tests. And I think there's been, there are companies who are trying to make rapid PCR-based testing. Mike Cepheid would be the one of the world leaders. That's a big plug for them. I've no relationship with them.
I'm sure their executives are listening right now and they appreciate that.
They'll give me some stock options or something. But they have been for quite a long time the world leaders in maybe rapid PCR testing might be the wrong term for it, but definitely encapsulated PCR testing, which would mean, suppose like you'd use in farming or in food, again, going back to that, like farm to fork, what they do is you pop the sample in and you get the result out the other end without doing any of the extractions. The machine does everything. It's a nice small machine. It's good. And they, I know, have brought out tests, rapid, but encapsulated PCR-based tests for COVID. I suppose we would be primarily focusing on, say, ELISA and rapid antibody-based
tests. Yeah. So let's touch on the antibody test, which we kind of mentioned briefly in the last episode with Dr. Andrew Hogan, but we can go into greater detail because this is your jam, you know. Your company has these amazing antibody test products, so let's chat about them. And the antibody tests, they're a little bit different to the DNA/RNA test that PCR offers. Mm-hmm. So we carry those out with a blood specimen, generally obtained from a little prick, which some of you may be used to. Oh, come on, Gary. No, that's just too early for jokes like that. So, Colm, how do the antibody tests work then?
Yeah. So, basically, like what you're trying to measure is the levels of antibodies in your blood. And the antibodies are produced in response to a foreign body invading your own body. And so we generate specific antibodies to specific antibodies. And in this case, it's SARS, COVID-19. And really, it offers a completely different type of picture to genetic PCR-based testing, because PCR detects the virus itself, and absolutely the virus, hopefully. I mean, if it's highly specific, 100%.
Yeah.
Whereas antibody testing will determine whether you have had the infection or have been exposed to it. And why that is interesting is, like, you might have the virus and it might be gone from your body and you might not be able to detect it with PCR, but how do you know if you've ever had it? And that's really where antibody testing comes in, because you'll have antibodies, or you should have antibodies present in your system. And therefore, if we can detect these antibodies, we can tell whether you have had an infection. And so there's multiple ways of doing this. One of them would be lateral flow. I'm holding it up here. See it. Well, you can see it.
We're not Joe Rogan here. We unfortunately haven't got the bandwidth to live stream on YouTube, but for the benefit of the people listening, he is in fact holding one up.
Jamie, pull that video up.
Yeah, a rapid test there. So I mean, there's different types. These are 15 minute tests, and there's limitations to them. We don't actually manufacture, as I mentioned earlier. We started developing, and we're still in the process. So we're actually selling rapid tests from other manufacturers, but we do provide ELISA kits, and I'll talk to you about ELISA technology in a sec as well, from our Assay Genie brand. But really, there's pros and cons. As I mentioned, like, it's really important to tell if you've had the virus or not. And if you've had the virus and you're clear of it and you can determine if you have antibodies to it, it means you're free to go back to work, you know, maybe 30 days later, and it's a good indicator. So it's really important for getting us all back to work. Then, as you might have seen in the media, there's problems with some of the technology as well. And they're not always as sensitive and specific as we would like. So there are some potentially false positives and false negatives, as we discussed previously. And for rapid tests, the pros are really it can be done in 15 minutes and it can be done anywhere. So you don't need instrumentation, you only need a drop of blood. But there are some limitations with the technology. And then you have ELISA, which is an enzyme-based and much more sensitive and much more specific, but you do need a lab to do it. Mm-hmm. Do it. And once again, really, you know, you can imagine if in an ideal situation, you should be testing somebody who presents with symptoms, or even before that, you check if they have the presence of virus with PCR, and then you want to see later on, did they raise antibodies to it, and have they been infected in the past?
So that's a really good point, Colm, you brought up about the timing of it, because a really good article from the Journal of the American Medical Association, I think it was in early May, and they had a really good graph about, you know, when you were likely to test positive on a PCR test and when you're likely to test negative, and also for the antibody testing. And they were showing that there's two antibodies, IgM, which is that's kind of your first responder, really. They develop early in an infection, and then your IgG are the ones that show up later, and they kind of hold the fort then going forward for a while. How long we get immunity, the jury is still out on that, but the graph was really good. It showed that the antibody production against SARS-CoV-2, that kind of appeared to start ramping up in like week two after onset of symptoms. So at this point in time, you're still likely to have a PCR test, and it kind of falls off, a positive PCR test And then around the start of week three, the IgM antibodies start to fall off and the IgG stays on board for the long haul, but it's not an exact science. So is this something you've seen? Like, does this kind of fall in line with the time frames that you guys are seeing as well with the antibody testing?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And that was a good synopsis as well, I suppose. You know, or seroconversion, really, you know, so the time it takes for an antibody to be detected in the blood is the term that we'd use as well. Look, absolutely. And I think that formed part of the problems at the beginning. We're going back maybe three months where people are, you know, testing, doing antibody tests and saying, look, they don't work. But actually, the antibodies just weren't present at the time. And you're dead right, 2 weeks after infection up to a month is kind of when you're going to really see strong responses either by, you know, ELISA or rapid tests. So it really is a time-dependent manner. And, you know, PCR and antibody testing need to work in synergy, really, to get a true picture of.
And you mentioned two terms there earlier, Colin, sensitivity and specificity. So for people that may not be familiar with antibody testing, can you kind of describe what those two metrics are?
Yeah, sure. The sensitivity really measures the ability to correctly generate a positive result. The reason I'm kind of laughing is that the terminology doesn't really match, in my opinion, what they actually mean around sensitivity and specificity. But so sensitivity really is, as I said, measures the ability to correctly generate a positive result. Say if you had 90% sensitivity, you'll identify 90 out of 100 people with the disease, or 10% will be false, which means really you've potentially 10% of the people out there with the disease that you haven't detected.
And as scientists, we typically like to work with 95% confidence or better. So is there a way we can, is the technology evolving at such a rate where we can bump those? Now, if you've ever seen The Wolf of Wall Street, those are rookie numbers. You got to pump those numbers up. Are we able to get them above 95%, or dare I say like 99%, where, you know, we're only missing one maybe out of 100 people are tested? Is that a realistic possibility, Colm?
Yeah, it really depends. I mean, there's some anecdotal evidence that those numbers have been met. There's so many variables around it. Like, I mean, you have to look at the publishing of these results to what was the what clinical cohort were used to generate these results. I think that's very, very important. Yeah, and you're a good synopsis earlier, looking at the seroconversion, the time factor, how severe these people's disease, how it was, and there's so many variables there. And then you're if you actually look from a technical perspective, how good the antibodies are, how good the recombinant proteins are to make all these tests. So there's a huge amount of variables. Can we make better antibodies and better proteins? Absolutely, let's do it. Can we make better materials? Once again, sure. And can we do really comprehensive clinical studies? Absolutely. And I think they all need to be done to really determine the true sensitivity and specificity of assays. And in a uniform manner then progress and allow us to build better products.
Yeah, and obviously, in case 2020 wasn't a fucking disaster of a year already to complicate things, there's seven different coronaviruses that cause illness in humans. So they can be, you know, mild symptoms like the common cold, or more severe in some cases like the SARS-CoV-2. So the antibodies in some cases for each coronavirus can appear similar. So are these tests must be pretty good then at deciphering between like your common cold antibody and COVID-19? Is that something that's been easily, that's kind of like a problem that's easily over, you can get over that problem fairly easy with these tests, can you? Because I've seen like a few tests where it's like, I've seen some results, not personal results, but I've seen results where it's showing antibodies, coronavirus antibodies, but it's still a negative test. So is that, maybe it's picking up antibodies that are from the common cold because there's a similar genetic similarity, I guess you could say, between some of the coronaviruses because they're from the same family. Is that something that's possible?
Look, it depends on what antibodies were generated to use in the actual test, in the actual rapid test or in the ELISA. And if those antibodies aren't, we'll just say, good enough, they might be picking up multiple different, they might be picking up or they might recognize a similar sequence that's common amongst different coronavirus proteins. So, yeah, those kind of issues. And I suppose once then we generate better, more specific antibodies to SARS-CoV-2, well then we can generate better test results. That has really happened, you know. So the latest tests from reputable sources will have very specific antibodies.
Sure. So you mentioned people getting back to work there earlier, Colm, and how antibody testing is so important. I know you've seen in the literature so far, there's vastly different percentages of people testing positive or antibodies in different parts of the country. I think there was a study of about 1,500 people there in New York, and that study showed greater than 10%. I think people in Manhattan, you know, obviously a more densely populated area, chances of people coming into contact with each other and spreading it and then mounting an antibody response would be quite higher. So some of the studies have shown greater than 10%, but then there's others less sparsely popular, more sparsely populated areas are well under double digit figures, which means, you know, I think it's obvious now herd immunity naturally is a long way away and probably impossible without a vaccine. So like how can we implement antibody testing going forward if we want to get people back to work, but it's, you know, so little people or such a low percentage of the population here in the US and other countries, even Sweden, who are trying to do the herd immunity route themselves. Like, do we really have to ramp up the antibody testing if we're going to be able to get people back to work? Assuming they have the antibodies and they have a long-term or, you know, somewhat of a long-term immune response against SARS-CoV-2. Like, do we really have to ramp up the testing column to get this going and get people back to work and the countries reopen?
Look, it's a good point. And I suppose, you know, there's kind of a mix then between what makes sense from a scientific perspective and a resource perspective versus, I suppose, public pressure on governments to implement something like this. And I think that's actually more of the problem. I think, you know, it's what people will want and what people will feel safe doing in coming back to work. Whether it's practical or necessary, I don't know. I mean, not really. I don't know if I can comment on that, but I think we will have to do something. But then again, let's see what happens with, and once again, if we, hopefully a vaccine will come in the market soon.
we're all hoping for that. Now that you mentioned it, I put Andy on the spot in the last episode, and I've gone on record to say I can't see it coming by the end of 2020. You know, just knowing how long clinical trials take and the checks and balances that need to go into a vaccine that's going to be, you know, given to so many people around the world. It's obvious that it has to be very, very robust and really nailed down with a fine tooth comb. So do you reckon we will see Atten by the end of 2020, or you think next year is a more realistic option?
I'd say next year. Yeah. It's okay. Just a task, you know, yourself. Like, I mean, the manufacturing, even, you know, you mentioned from a trials perspective, absolutely, and maybe there's some leeway around it now. You might skip this stage. I don't think they're saying that, actually, but
I hope not.
Actually, skip the trial bit, just go straight to humans. Gary Somerville here. I think he'll
he'll take a needle in the arm, go for it. I mean, money is money for a few quid, we'll see what happens.
One, they were signing me up. Like,
the last thing we want is like a Hunger Games scenario, you know, where you've got like District 1 are the first ones to get it, and then
happy Hunger Games, and may the odds be ever in your favor.
Fucking District 12 and 14 are having to, you know, fight just to get in line and stuff like that. It's gonna be, like you said, it's gonna be a monumental task. Like, is it like a what's the movie where with Lawrence Fishburne in it? Is it Contagion, where there's like a lottery basically? Or who, like, how are we gonna do it? How are we gonna give the vaccine out to people, Colm? Like, it's crazy all the variables that are gonna go into this thing.
Mental, absolutely crazy. Yeah.
We're just the scientists. We're not the ones in charge of making those decisions. So we have less stress, thankfully, when it comes to the vaccine sort of things. Before I let you go, Colm, you may have heard on the previous episodes that I like to do this thing called a shot of science. I'm going to put you on the spot here. You probably have nothing prepared. But can you give the listeners just some crazy fact that they can impress their mates next time we actually go to a pub? Remember when we used to go to pubs? That was nice, wasn't it? A couple of months ago now. But the next time one of these listeners is down talking science as people do in their local pub, having a few points, have you got any crazy kind of facts about like antibodies or testing or anything like that that will blow out our minds, Callum?
Jeez, that is after putting me on the spot.
You've got 10 or 15 seconds to think of one, so go for it.
Right, I think I'm going to kind of just ride that 10 or 15 seconds out and kind
of go on, have a think.
Session times. You know,
think about,
you know, I don't have anything, but just I did learn something else the other day which blew my mind, and it's not science related.
It's grand, go for it.
I can't think of any science stuff, but a club sandwich, okay, that actually stands for chicken lettuce under bacon.
Really? Jeez, I have no idea.
There you go, that blew my mind.
We did say like cooking and making food earlier on kind of is a scientific process, so we can kind of angle that in. You're putting the ingredients in and you're making the sandwich, so we can kind of make a science aspect to it with the club sandwich. Where did you read that, by the way? Was it Cosmopolitan or something like that, those magazines you're reading?
Yeah, Men's Weekly, just, you know, working out.
Getting the bicep curls in and eating a few club sandwiches.
It is a fiddle, like, don't look at me. No.
Right. Well, you have a lot of busy stuff to do as a CEO and founder of a company. Do you want to give a last shout out there, Colin, to the company in case there's scientists listening here that may be interested in trying out some of the tests you guys have going on?
Yeah, great. Where the company, really, our main brands are Eliza Genie and Assay Genie, and both .coms, so you can find everything there. And we've developed loads of stuff too, but I'd just like to say, I mean, I've really enjoyed working with everybody. It's been a crazy journey.
I've been following your progression over the years with the Genie companies, and it's great to see an Irishman kind of breaking through in the scientific reagent world. So, and you, in the day of the age of the influencer, rather, your Insta goes by, I had to ask you about this, the real Colm Ryan. Is that because there's a load of imposter Colm Ryans pretending to be you, or what's the story there?
There was, that's kind of a funny story, really, but there is another Colm Ryan.
A lesser Colm Ryan.
No, actually, so, yeah, I didn't want to, like, I was going to ask him to change his social media to that, but no, there was, there's Colm Ryan, he's a professor in UCD in Dublin, and actually, there was a few more Colm Ryan's handles already taken, so I just said I'd change that and have a consistent handle across all social media.
Love it. Colm, thanks very much for taking time out to chat to us here on Barstool Biology.
Great. Thanks a lot, Gary. Cheers. Appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to Barstool Biology and learning all about the science behind COVID-19 testing. In future, if you get a weird looking stick up your nose or a needle in your arm, now you know what happens after that. A massive shout out to everyone who has subscribed to the podcast so far and given fantastic feedback. It's now also available on Google Podcasts and Stitcher, so you can check it out there. I'm really enjoying reading the reviews people are giving on the iTunes store, so that is much appreciated. If Barstool Biology is your new favourite science podcast, a cheeky little review about why you like it on Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts would be fantastic. Let's get this bad boy moving up the rankings. If you know people interested in learning some science, your hairdresser, now that we're all getting out for a haircut, your pizza delivery driver, your priest, well, maybe not them, feel free to share the podcast with them. I'm Gary Somerville. This has been Barstool Biology. Tune in next time for more facts and not feelings, where I will be serving up science.